We are happy to welcome back to the program a gentleman who has won a number of Emmy Awards for his films. He's earned a couple of Academy Award nominations. He is America's documentarian, telling the story of America through film for more than four decades now. His newest, Muhammad Ali, premieres on PBS Sunday night at 8 p.m. We are happy to welcome back to the program, Ken Burns. Hi there, Ken. How are you today?
Good, Rich. I'm well. How are you doing?
I'm doing very good, thank you. Enjoyed this so much as somebody who grew up with Ali, and just an absolutely wonderful film.
Oh, I'm so glad you liked it. Thank you.
Well, one of the things I liked most about it was the scope. I mean, we knew Ali the boxer, and that's obviously the central part of the story, but I thought it was so great to learn about his young life, his family, marriage, his parenting, and all of that, and it gave us such a complete picture of the man.
Well, I think that that's, in essence, one of the main reasons why we wanted to do it. Obviously, he's such a compelling figure, one of the most compelling figures of the 20th century, and has much to speak to us today still. But I think also there have been a lot of Ali documentaries, and they've been wonderful. They've taken, though, a particular fighter a couple of years, and what we were interested, the we being Sarah Burns and David McMahon, my co-directors, and they also wrote the script. We wanted to take a much more comprehensive view and understand who this person was, where he came from, as you suggest, the birth and boyhood in Jim Crow Louisville, segregated Louisville, Kentucky, to his death from Parkinson's, you know, 5 years ago, not that many years ago, and dying the most beloved person on the planet after being so reviled at times in the United States or by a large portion of people in the United States. So his relationship to sports, to I guess what you'd say is sort of his redefinition of black manhood, the intersection with civil rights when he joined a separatist religious sect, cult, his own faith, his own developing faith, the war and politics, his refusal to be inducted in the United States Army, all of those things I thought were really important, as well as you pointed out, the personal life. I'm glad you said that. I think they paint a fuller, more complex, more nuanced portrait of him than just sort of the conventional wisdom, the baggage that we carry with us about who we think he might have been.
One of the things that comes through repeatedly in the course of the film is this strong sense of self that he possessed. How did he develop that?
Oh, you know what? This is a great, great question and a great mystery, I think. You know, he's banging pots and pans in the kitchen at 1 year old. You can see it in school. You can see a kind of confidence and transcendence from the normal things that imprison teenagers. And then in boxing, he's breaking every single possible rule, not just in the sport of boxing, but in how you promote them. He's predicting the round in which his opponent's going to fall. He's reciting poetry. He's bragging about himself. And we're seeing it all as kind of, well, that's not a way an athlete should behave, particularly a black athlete. And we're forgetting that he's speaking for people all around the world, as well as black Americans specifically, who are being brought up by his message of affirmation. And he even says it at one point, you know, I may not continue boxing, when his own cult, you know, the Nation of Islam, suggested that sports wasn't a reasonable thing. And he said, but I know I'm here for a reason. So he even saw, quite apart from what he actually did for a living, which he did better than anyone else, the greatest athlete of the 20th century, without a doubt, he also knew he had another purpose, and I think by the end of his life, dying as he did, the most beloved man on earth, he realized that his message is one of love. There's a great photograph early on when he's training for the Liston fight at the second floor of the Fifth Street gym, a walk-up, and there is the same year as the Beatles invasion, and there are John, Paul, George, and Ringo in a kind of faked photograph in which Ali is punching Lennon, and they all seem to be toppling like dynamite. It's a wonderful, joyous, totally fake, wonderful PR shot. And yet I realized that these five men were, you know, at the forefront. They are apostles of love as the only solution to the world's problems. And it's so interesting that Muhammad Ali took his course through such a brutal sport, but nonetheless ended up in the same place as the Beatles, you know, epitomized, I suppose, by Paul McCartney's line, "The love you take is equal to the love you make." That's so much about what Muhammad Ali is about.
You unearthed so many wonderful photographs from early in his life, that and the video of him at the Rome Olympics. And I've seen you mention this in a couple other interviews, but my goodness, what a beautiful man young Cassius Clay was.
He's gorgeous. As he said, "I'm pretty as a girl. You know, aren't I handsome?" And he would play it up, but he was. He was all of that. He was a magnificent, chiseled specimen of a human being, and he understood that there was a beauty in that that transcended kind of any gender. It was just about looking good and feeling good, and he did. And the poise and the self-confidence in him is so wonderful. Yes, you know, PBS allows us the time. I wouldn't exist without PBS. They allow us the time to really do the deep dives and find footage that his daughter, Rashida, said, you know, she wept watching it, you know. There was her daddy, as she calls him. There was daddy, and there was one thing where we had of him holding her as a little baby and saying, "Don't you know your daddy is the baddest person on earth?" And she'd never seen it before. And when you hear that from family, or you've shown warts and all, which the film does, we're, you know, certainly not uncritical of him, and particularly womenizing and his, you know, abandonment of Malcolm X, a little bit more understandable, and his completely irresponsible treatment of Joe Frazier and many other opponents, using the language that a white racist would use against the black man. And here he was, the ultimate, as Todd Boyd says in our film, the ultimate conscious black man, you know. And Todd goes on to say he clearly used his powers for evil and not good in that point of view. So we're critical, and yet the family has been responding so far just so positively. It's been very exciting.
We're talking with Ken Burns here on Downtown. Many ironies in the story of Ali, and one of them is that by the early 60s, pro boxing was largely controlled by the mob, and yet it was a group of white Louisville businessmen that really served to protect Clay from all of that.
Yeah. You can't make this stuff up, right? I mean, you're absolutely right. Everybody's mobbed up, you know, including Sonny Liston in some way, shape, or form. And here comes this kid who wins the gold at the Rome Olympics, and then the proud fathers of Louisville, segregated Louisville, band together, 11 of them, to form a syndicate to protect their native son. The local boy does good. And they go to Hollywood and they study child contracts of stars like Shirley Temple, and they form an incredibly great thing, a protective ring around him. They put him on a salary. They pay all his expenses. They give him at least half the gate. You know, everybody's taken care of. Everybody's happy, and he's protected. And the irony is, of course, that it doesn't protect them from him and his curiosity about the world, who is being drawn for the first time to any kind of real spiritual discipline in this cult, the Nation of Islam. It's just a story that, you know, Hollywood would find a little bit too convoluted, too impossible to believe, and yet it's totally believable because it's true. And there's one moment where the membership that he's now announced in the Nation of Islam has really caused some sponsors to balk. And a British reporter is interviewing William Faversham, who's the sort of the spokesman of this group of 11 businessmen. And he's sort of pressing him in a kind of, the way the media does about this. And has he lost money? Yes, he maybe lost $1 million from certain, you know, endorsements. And he goes, and isn't this ironic that a group of 11 white Kentucky businessmen, Christians, should be, you know, this? And he goes, well, you know, most of us believe that a man is entitled to his belief. Mm. You go, score one for the Constitution. And he stops and he says, and if the Nation of Islam is a hate group, then he can't ever be a member, because this man does not have a bone of hate in his body. And so they figured it out long before the rest of us, who they had, this incredible person. And as perhaps distracting, as destructive, as problematic as the Nation of Islam was for him, not just with white Americans, but for many black Christians who were subscribing to the mostly Christian, mostly Southern civil rights movement, the message of separatism did not go down easy. Nonetheless, by the time he's gotten out of the Vietnam problem and, you know, regained his title, everybody is for him. You know, he suddenly, he was right. He was right about Vietnam. He was right about this. But more importantly, he stood for his conviction. And at the end of the day, no matter how racist you are, no matter how prejudiced you are, no matter how much you dislike this, you have to actually admire someone who said, I'm willing to face machine gun fire, then abandon the principles of his faith.
You point out in the film that, that to a lot of people, though, that, that conversion to the Nation of Islam was not viewed as a religious move, but political.
That's right. And I think that, that this is where, you know, our country's racist slip is showing, because, you know, we had, including the Supreme Court, permitted Jehovah's Witnesses to claim conscientious objector status based on their religion. But Ali, first Clay, about Ali's conversion to the Nation of Islam, which was not Islam, it was a kind of hybrid American sect, and as we know, had lots of corruption in it and lots of dangers. They are the murderers of Malcolm X once they'd have expelled him from their organization. You know, it nonetheless just put the his blackness made it just a political thing and not something that was based on faith. And of course, our country is as it is as important in the founding of our country that we be able to worship God as we see fit as it is to have the kind of political freedoms that we mostly talk about. And that, I think, is often missed in a discussion of American history. And so he represents, you know, what Roger Williams and what Anne Hathaway and Anne Hutchinson, I should say, and others represent in the early days of the colonies, this desire to be able to worship how you wanted to, free of the dictates of whatever the dominant religion was. And we ended up starting a country without a religion at the center of it.
Here in Maine, we're happy to be a part of the Cassius Clay Muhammad
indeed.
Ali story with the
indeed,
second fight. what's known
that
as the phantom,
as you can get.
The phantom punch, the whole idea of this happening at this little armory in Lewiston, Maine, and then for it to go the way it did, it's a remarkable chapter, I think, in the history of American sports.
It is. It's just so completely improbable. You just have to chuckle. The game is slated for Boston. Muhammad Ali gets you know, disease as an operation, herniated something or other, and he has to recover, and Sonny Liston, who's been training well, has fallen out of shape, and they get back together, and now the Boston state attorney general isn't sure that Boston's going to get the right thing, and that is there mob money involved and taxes, and so all of a sudden, at the last minute, it's canceled, and then this little venue in Lewiston, the home of the CYO team, comes out and says, we'll do it, and all of a sudden, the world descends on tiny Lewiston, Maine, and becomes the center of what is thought to be this incredible grunge match between Liston, who hadn't expected the upstart play, then to dominate him as he did in the very first fight, despite the liniment that his corner put on his gloves so that it would get into Ali's eyes. It's a hugely dramatic first fight. But one presumed that Liston would come back, and obviously by, you know, the middle of the first round, he'd realize that it was going to go the same way as the previous fight, maybe even more so, and just waited until he got a halfway decent punch, or not even halfway decent punch, and went down. Or the punch was so miraculous that to this day, none of us can figure out how he did it. Or, of course, there's some rumor that it's fixed. But I can't believe that the Ali, the Clay Ali folks would have had anything to do with it. And I can't imagine, just for his reputation, that Liston would have at that time chosen to take a dive. You know, there's no there's no reasonable explanation for what happened other than perhaps, you know, Liston just kind of said, as David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker and a great writer about boxing and an author of the early life of Cassius Clay, you know, so maybe he just said, oh, the hell with it, and I'll wait for a good punch, and went down.
Episode 3 focuses on the rivalry, and I have such a vivid memory. There were no people in the middle. You were on one side or the other in 1971 for the first Ali-Frazier fight, the fight of the century.
Right.
And the film makes a pretty compelling case that it was that loss to Joe Frazier that changed the perception and really humanized Ali.
Yeah, it's paradoxical. So the world is divided between Ali and Frazier fans. Ali represents black power, a new black consciousness. He's got this, you know, bravado. He's the greatest. He's taken a principled stand. He's been, you know, he's lost 3.5 years of his professional life. He doesn't know really what's going to happen. Frazier is the champion in his absence, and they're going to get together. It's the lead up to it. It's the fight of the century, and most of the black intelligentsia would be for Ali, without a doubt, and a good deal of the black world, because Ali had helped paint the idea that Frazier was the champion of the white man, and a lot of white people wanted to shut up Ali, and so they supported Frazier less for him than for the political statement, and because it was such a divisive time. And Frazier wins, and he wins decisively, and in the last round, Ali goes down when he's trying hard to come back and see if he can equal in points or get a knockout. And he goes down, he jumps right back up, and the decision is against him unanimously. And he's very respectful after the fight. He talks about his responsibility to show people how to lose as well as how to win at his first loss as a professional. And it's beautiful. You can't believe the wisdom coming out of this still young man's mouth about how, you know, everybody's going to lose a job or lose a loved one or a title, and you have to show that life goes on and you can take it. It's the opposite of the Ali you've spent most of your time knowing, but we've also gotten into some little before used or seen footage of him with that wisdom all the way along. And it's at that point, Robert Lipsight, was a reporter, followed first Clay and then Ali from the beginning of his life. He said, you know, in a way, Joe Frazier won the fight, but Ali won America, because he'd taken a principled stand. He stood up for it. He lost like a man. And all of a sudden, people were beginning to look at him saying, you know, it's 71. Maybe he was right on Vietnam or sort of out of there. Not quite, but it didn't work out. He was right about it. He's acted this way. Maybe I'm going to give him a second chance. And he becomes a hero to a lot of little kids, black and white, who put, as the biographer Jonathan Eich says, his poster up on his wall when he was a kid, because all of a sudden, whatever the conventional wisdom was about him, I had grown up loving him, but you know, was beginning to change. And then by the time he regains his title 3 years later, it's just in one of the most magnificent fights ever. You can't help but realize that he's made a complete passage, as Howard Bryant, the sports journalist, says. You know, he's made himself whole, and he's turned the narrative in his favor. But he's got two. He wins the second bout with Frazier, and then he's got a third one after the Rumble in the Jungle. That is perhaps the greatest fight of all time, only because it ought to have been the last fight ever, right? For not only Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier, but for the boxing. You should have just said, you know what, folks, this was a great sport, but now we've seen the pinnacle of it. It's so difficult, that third Frazier fight. And it is, you know, Ali himself said it was the closest to death he ever came.
Yeah, a friend of our show, Jerry Eisenberg, said insight that for each, the other guy was Ahab's white whale.
Yeah, Jerry's wonderful. He, Lipsight, and Sam Kindred are all coming up as young Turks about the time that Ali, Cassius Clay, and then Ali are coming up, and they sort of go with him, and they follow him. They begin to love him. It's not an un-self-critical love, but it's it's there. And you know that Eisenberg, his metaphor goes beyond Moby Dick into many other images, that you know that this old man is quoting the column he wrote as a relatively young man back in that at the time of that fight at the thriller in Manila, and that's okay because there are very few words to describe what actually happens. It's exhausting. It was exhausting as filmmakers to cut it down to the right size. It when you watch it, it's exhausting in a good way. You know, it's not like I can't look at it anymore. It's just that this is a spectacular battle. You know, there's nothing in Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter that matches that fight for the kind of epic scope that this one has. And it wasn't good against evil. It was two good men who sometimes didn't do good things, trying to survive for 14 rounds. And you realize, you know, 3 minutes is an eternity, the length of a round. And the fact, what they went through is, I still shake my head in disbelief when I think about what happened in that fight.
The Frazier fight, it was certainly, if not the beginning, close to the beginning of Ali's physical decline, and then the loss to Leon Spinks, the comeback, making history as the only three-time champion, and then the Larry Holmes fight. And I thought that was so poignant, Larry Holmes talking about breaking down after the fight of his friendship with Ali.
Yeah, it's very mixed and very, very complicated because, you know, he had sort of shown up kind of a snotty-nosed kid from Easton, not too far away from the Deer Lake training grounds where Ali had been, you know, working out for years and years, and they put him to work. He became a sparring partner. Ali taught him a lot of stuff, and then he rose through the ranks. And so he both was anxious to dispatch Ali, and he did it with a kind of vigor that his tears later on belie. But I also think no one's ever been like him. No one has ever been like Muhammad Ali. So I think there's something very much, it's very painful for Holmes to also, at the same time as he relishes his heavyweight championship, he also understands that he is never going to be the center of the story the way Muhammad Ali was, even in that defeat.
The film does a wonderful job at looking at Ali's personal life, his role as a father, complicated because he was on the road a lot, and it may have been Belinda or even one of his daughters who talked about how, you know, he was a great dad for a while, but then needed to get on.
That's Belinda, or Talila, as she changed her name, his second wife, and she had to put up with a lot. And I think part of it, and every man, if he's honest, will acknowledge the fact that they haven't been, or most every man will acknowledge they haven't been the most perfect father, that there is a kind of attention span that they and you have, and kids sometimes get handed over, as Belinda Kalila says, after 20 minutes, he's had enough. But they loved him, and the wives loved him even for the womanizing. There's no acrimony. There's pain, and the memory of pain, and both his second and third wives, Belinda and Veronica, are open and generous to us about what can't be a very happy thing, but they got close to greatness. And the children, who ended up spending a lot of time with their moms or their grandparents didn't see their dad as much as kids would like to see their dad, have this kind of reverential love and respect for him. And one of them, we interviewed his daughter Hannah and his daughter Rashida, both of the union with Belinda. And Rashida seems to carry, it seems to me, a little bit of that Ali magic. She says, "Daddy, you feel his presence." And she understood his message of love. And at one point, towards the end of the film, she squeezes her fingers together and says, you know, to a tiny little crack, and says, "Boxing was only this much. You know, he could have been a simple carpenter, right? And we know where simple carpenters can go." So I think that she sort of carries that. And we're blessed by having his brother, having neighbors, having cornermen, having the experts, the biographers like Jonathan Haig, the reporters, the scholars like Gerald Early and Todd Boyd, and the writer Walter Mosley and David Remnick, and all of these people who help kind of help us see him from a variety of vantage points and give us a much more dimensional, I guess that's the word I would use, a much more dimensional and fuller portrait of him as a human being, as well as a boxer. And we embedded the heavyweight, former heavyweight champion Michael Bent, within every significant boxing match to show us not only the strategy and tactics for those of us, the majority of us, who aren't interested in boxing, but also the psychology and the wills and the hearts and the kind of personal drama that's taking place so quickly at these nanoseconds of jabs and punches and lunges and head flicks and getting out of the way. I mean, it's just, I learned so much working on this film. It's still hard sometimes to consider the sport, but Muhammad Ali was the best at it ever. And he makes us curious about it. I mean, you know, it's so funny. I'm a big baseball fan, and I make baseball films till the cows come home. But I've now made two films totaling 12 hours, 8 hours of Ali and 4 hours of Jack Johnson, a film about the first African-American heavyweight champion back in the first and second decades of the 20th century. Because the person, in this case, the two men, transcend the sport itself and reflect a larger country, good and bad, and what it actually means to be a man, what it actually means to be free, Muhammad Ali and Jack Johnson's big theme in their life, and what it means to try to do that as a black man in America, which is, as anyone would admit, complicated by the color of his skin and not, unfortunately, as Dr. King would wish, by the content of the character.
Dealing with Parkinson's, to extend that metaphor, the cross he had to bear in the last years of his life, in many ways elevated his image, the perception of him, because of the grace and the humility and the way, the good humor in which he dealt with it. And his kids, wives say the same thing, that they never heard him complain.
Yeah. It's magnificent. It's really great. In fact, I'll take an idea that Michael J. Fox, the actor who has Parkinson's as well, impressed me with 30 years ago. He said, "I couldn't be still until I couldn't be still," meaning the shake and palsy. And it's a wonderful sense of finding yourself and finding an inner peace, even with all this outside agitation and the way it seals you off from the world. This is, in Muhammad Ali, one of the most voluble, loud, outspoken people on the planet. And in a way, when he was silenced, he suddenly became an even greater spokesperson for the world. And so in a way, he couldn't really speak until he couldn't really speak, and then became this kind of apostle of love, as I suggest.
Well, and there's irony, too, in the fact that this man who rose to prominence in the most violent of sports became known as a man of peace and love. And it's that part of the spell, as you point out, that remains.
Yes, that's exactly right. We have to, at the end, after all the trials and tribulations, all the ups and downs, all the hatred and the love, all of that stuff, just wonder what it was held over us. You know, he was something very, very special, and it's this is a hero's journey, and it's also a mythic story in which obviously the strengths and the failures are writ large, as the Greeks did it in their gods, but they become lessons for the rest of us of how we might conduct ourselves, how to be true to ourselves, how to be brave and courageous, how to persevere through obstacles, how to understand and try to atone for your own failings. All of these are huge parts of the life of Muhammad Ali that don't really fit in conveniently to the superficial, conventional wisdom we have of him.
You have told so many stories through the years. Has there been an American life like Muhammad Ali's?
No. No, I mean, if you were going to invite people to dinner, you know, you'd want to talk to Abraham Lincoln. You'd want to talk to Louis Armstrong. You'd want to have Muhammad Ali there, Ida B. Wells, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Franklin Roosevelt. I mean, there are just a handful of people who are so utterly American that you just stand and shake your hands and go, wow. And you know what? There's lots of unheralded people, so-called ordinary people. And what I've learned in all the bottom-up practice that I do in history and storytelling is that there are no ordinary people at the end of the day. You know, people who got off LSD on June 6, 1944 in France. And they weren't there for economic gain or conquest or empire. They were there for some ideas. They're as heroic as anybody I've ever met.
Well, it's a wonderful tribute to you and David and Sarah, the writers and researchers, that in four episodes, 8 hours, on the most famous man perhaps in the history of the United States of America, we learn a whole lot of new things, and that's a wonderful work by all of you to let us find a new Cassius Clay, a new Muhammad Ali in this story.
Well, then, you've made my day, Ben. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed speaking with you.
Our friend Ken Burns, the new film that he directed, produced, along with Sarah Burns and David McMahon, Muhammad Ali, premieres Sunday night, 8 o'clock on PBS.